What's up, everybody? Welcome to Future Projection, a Baseball America podcast brought to you by myself, Carlos Collazo, and Ben Badler. It is Wednesday morning. We're in the middle of the playoffs. And Ben, how's it going, man?
I'm great. This is the best time of the year. It's playoff, baseball, handbook season. Everything is going on right now.
Yes, there is a lot going on. I know I'm done with travel. Jupiter just wrapped up in between our last podcast. And now I think you're done with travel as well. Is that correct? Or you still have some stuff you're getting out to?
I may try to sneak in a little visit or two here or there. But yeah, that's one of the challenges we always have too, right? I was on the road for a couple of weeks in Fort Myers, seeing some of the WWBA, like the sophomore and the underclass event, went over and saw the minority baseball prospects, All America game. Those were all awesome. And it's like, man, like I'd love to go to Jupiter too, but I know we have you're there, Teddy's there. So we had some folks there covering it. And it's like, I gotta get back and write. Like when I'm on the road, I don't have time to, really be producing content for our site. So it's always a balance. It's good to be able to just be home and kind of digest and really analyze everything sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have a bunch of content up from Jupiter. We're going to talk about the Jupiter event and players who stood out a little bit later in the podcast, but we have a lot to get to today. As you said, it's a very busy month. We're probably going to ignore the NBA opening night. I don't think you have anything to say about LeBron James, Ben, but a few interesting...
Didn't know he played.
There you go. True baseball American. Love it. A few notable things to kind of touch on before we get into the meat of the episode. I feel like the biggest piece of news that came out in between this episode and our last episode was the announcement that Major League Baseball is going to require teams to provide housing for minor league players starting as soon as next year. Jeff Passan originally broke this story for ESPN. But this is something that I feel like we've talked about for a while now, and I feel like we have steadily taken some nice steps forward for quality of life improvements for minor league players. I know there was a lot of animosity just with the minor league restructuring and how Major League Baseball was kind of handling all of that. But this is great to see. Obviously, we'll need to see the details of how this is going to unfold. I think there's a specific wording in this that certain minor league players were going to have housing provided, which is kind of interesting. I'm curious to see why it's not just all minor league players. But this is a really important step forward, I think. I know just dealing with housing for minor league players who aren't guaranteed they're going to be in one location for the entire summer and have to deal with various leases and bouncing back and forth on some occasions, or just sharing a room with six other people. It's not an ideal situation for developing as a player, or just the mental health that you're dealing with throughout the season. So I was excited to see this. Do you have any thoughts in general on this? Obviously, it's pretty long overdue, either this or just increasing the pay.
I think, like you said, we really need to see the specifics of what MLB is planning. So I think do that and then we'll talk, because I do not trust Major League Baseball when it comes to what they say, especially when they speak in these generalities about their plans to change things and make things better for minor league players. I think their statement was, it was PR, the story on their website. Ooh, look, it did not have any specifics on what's happening, and they know that they are getting hammered publicly to the point where they're positioned on paying minor league players salaries of, $10,000 or less per year is just no longer tenable. There is just too much pushback. It's coming more from other media outlets as well. It's coming from fans. It's coming from minor league players and even major league players. Now we're starting to speak out more. So the folks who work in the commissioner's office and PR for MLB, they know that MLB and the owners are not the good guys in this story of how minor league baseball players are paid and how they're treated. So they come out with this statement, and they did exactly what I said before on this podcast. It's the statement starts, this is a story on MLB.com. So it starts as Major League Baseball continues its commitment to a first-class development system. The league's 30 owners are closing in on an announcement for the new housing policy at all levels of the minor leagues. Like, really? This is MLB committing itself to a first-class player development? All right. So then the statement that MLB puts out is MLB is engaged in a multi-year effort to modernize the minor league system and better assist players as they pursue their dreams of playing in the major leagues. So MLB has, they for years have been paying minor league players as little as they can get away with. They've spent millions of dollars lobbying Congress to make sure that they are exempt from laws that would require them to pay minor league players more money. And they cut down on the number of minor league teams, which means fewer opportunities for players to pursue their dreams of playing in the major leagues, as MLB puts it. So then the statement says, in 2021, we increased the salaries for minor league players by 38 to 72%, depending on level, and significantly reduce travel requirements during the season, and then it goes on. But this is exactly what I'm talking about before, where MLB PR is going to hammer home the percentage salary increases.
Yes.
That they gave minor league players.
I feel like anytime you see a salary increase that large, you should immediately be skeptical of the actual money, because that is massive. But then you look at what the actual money is starting at.
I don't doubt that the math is accurate. Like,
oh yeah, no doubt.
Like a 50% raise sounds great, right? Mm-hmm. But like what you're saying is obviously that, you know, look, they're never going to put the actual annual salaries that they pay these players in their releases, mm-hmm. because it is an embarrassment to say, hey, we increased a player's salary from $7,000 a year to $10,000 a year.
Yep.
Right? Who cares about the percentage increase when you have a professional athlete in your minor league system who has been there for multiple years, who is still making a salary of under $10,000 a year? So if you see somebody citing the percentage salary increase they gave the players this year, they're either, you know, just getting paid directly by MLB, or their PR efforts have successfully worked mm-hmm. on them, because what matters is what they're getting paid. Yep. Not what the percentage increase is when you're starting from that low of a base.
Yeah. No, I think you're absolutely right to be critical of them, Ben. A lot of this is just MLB patting itself on the back. But I do think at the same time, I'm still excited that some things are starting to happen. Like you said, there's still a long way to go. These guys are still not making very much money. But I think JJ mentioned it in his story when this happened. But there are going to be players who will be able to stick in professional baseball because of this, and because of the steps that hopefully continue to be taken that will allow us to see major league players that in a previous universe would not have existed. They would have had to leave minor league baseball for financial reasons. And I do think it's good to see that more major league players seem to be focusing on this issue for minor league players, because for a while, at least several years ago, it seemed like mostly no one really cared at the major league level, or if they did, I don't know how aware I was of that, or how vocal those players were. But it's also nice to see groups like the Advocates for Minor Leaguers and More Than Baseball having some impact on the quality of life for minor league players. And hopefully at some point after, I'm assuming we'll get the details of what specifically this is going to look like after the CBA is finalized. I'd imagine it's baked into that in some capacity, but we should know the details before the 2022 season, which is good. And we'll have to circle back at that point and really break it down fully to see what we're looking at, what kind of a situation we're looking at. But I guess before we move on to the next little topic here is, do you have confidence that we're kind of on the right path for minor leaguers? Obviously, you aren't too thrilled with the current situation as it stands now, but do you think we're headed towards a more sustainable minor league system in the game?
I think we need to see what the details of this housing policy are first, and MLB has not come out with any of those details. They've just come out with some generalities in a PR statement, because I suspect with housing, like what is MLB doing here? I don't know. I suspect that there's going to be a lot of catches and caveats here along the way. I think the reason we're seeing housing for players come before owners deciding to pay their athletes a wage that is, you know, above a poverty level salary is because if you raise salaries across the board, let's say like if you're going to go out and pay every minor leaguer $30,000 or $40,000 a year, that's going to cost each owner millions of dollars in labor costs. So you can say, well, what's a few million dollars to somebody who's worth $1 billion, but they still don't want to lose a couple million dollars in salaries and in annual costs too, if they don't have to, because once you pay that money to players as an owner, you don't get it back. But housing is different, because with housing, I mean, if you own a major league team, you can just purchase real estate, and the value of that asset that you purchase is more than likely going to appreciate over time. So if you buy an apartment complex, you can rent out the rooms that are not being used by players. When players are not living there in the off season, you can rent out those rooms too, whether it's through a traditional lease, through Airbnb. Like, hey, come live where the Yankees minor league players live.
What right? a nightmare. So, actually being like publicized. Holy cow.
but the point that they're buying an appreciating asset that comes in with incoming cash flows, that is a much more appealing option for MLB owners instead of increasing player salaries. So while I understand why players are happy about the news that came out, and they should be, I would still be careful to put much faith into what MLB is suggesting they're going to do until concrete details actually come out about who is going to be eligible for these housing benefits, what the benefits will actually be. And still the biggest issue is that MLB is paying players these salaries of $12,000 or less in many cases, and trying to spin this as a win for players when raising salaries should still be the most important issue for minor league players.
Well said, Ben. And now in equally serious news, I wanted to bring up a tweet by Kevin Goldstein, who works for Fangraphs and was a previous Baseball American, obviously worked for the Astros. He brought up I think we talked about this on a previous podcast, just how we pronounce stats. I learned that Kevin also says ops or OPS like a word. So it's good to know he is of sound mind. And apparently Matt Myers replied to this thread. It kind of blew up the baseball Twitter sphere, at least that I'm exposed to online. Apparently ops is like a BA tradition. Apparently Jim Callis and John Manuel both are also ops guys. So I'm very proud to kind of continue in that line. And it seems like, Ben, you have strayed afar. You need to take a stand now.
If you
want
to continue to embarrass yourself on this topic, I'm not going to stop you from being on the wrong side of history here. As much respect as I have for John and Jim, they're, you guys are just not on the right side of history on this one.
Here's what I don't understand. It seems like, first of all, this is really not something that I like consciously ever thought about. It's just when you get on a podcast and you come into these stats, when you 90% of the time, you don't have to think about it because you're writing about these rather than talking about them. It's one syllable versus three syllables. It's as simple as that for me, Ben. You're wasting your time with OPS. We could save listeners precious amount of seconds and even minutes, depending on the podcast, by saying ops versus OPS.
But you don't. What about WRC plus?
Tell me what's wrong with ops. See, that's the thing. If the vowels are placed correctly, you can say it as a word. And if they're not, you just have to say it as the acronym. I will never do work plus. I will stand here and tell you that I will never say work plus seriously on the podcast. I will always say WRC plus. But WOBA, the vowels line up for me to say it as a word. So it just makes more sense. And God forbid, I'm never going to say batting average on balls in play.
I think Connor pointed out you don't.
This is Connor Glassy, who works for the Indians now as a scout and is a previous Baseball American, for those who don't know.
But not ERA.
Yeah, I wonder what. I'm sure that one is just. It's an old stat that even the old heads can appreciate, and it was just established as ERA. But now in an age where we have stats coming out on the regular, I think it's easier to just start saying some of those as a word. Like ERA, it was already established. You know, when WAR came out, no one knew what it meant, so we just said it as a word. I don't know. Do you want to say ERA? Well, WAR, is that your argument? Or you should say WAR?
No, WAR is the stat. WAR is also a word. Ops is not a stat. Ops is just something ops is not a word. It's just something.
Baseball ops? It's a shortened word.
Baseball operation. That's different. That's you're talking about baseball operations.
Yeah, but you're talking about WAR the stat versus WAR the word, which obviously those are different. I just don't understand the logic here, Ben. I think you're wrong here.
I think the listeners should not hold this against us if you're rating the podcast of Carlos's mispronunciation of OPS.
All right, we'll take a poll on our various Twitter accounts, and we'll see that I'm on the right side of history here. But how much of the MLB playoffs have you watched, Ben? I know you're busy, got a lot of stuff going on, but the NLCS, which is now 2-1 in favor of Atlanta after a really tight game, has been great, I feel like, the whole time. The ALCS, a little bit less great, at least if you want close games. I think that series has been compelling for a number of reasons as well. But what are your thoughts on the postseason so far?
Yeah. It's been awesome, man. It's like you said, some of these Red Sox Astros games have been a little not quite as exciting. I mean, obviously a lot of home runs, a lot of offense. But yeah, I don't know. What are your thoughts? That Dodgers Braves game yesterday. I mean, it was tough because the Red Sox Astros series was going at the same time. I was trying to flip back and forth, but did not expect Cody Bellinger to be coming up in that kind of situation and delivering.
Don't hold me to this, but I think I saw on Reddit, on baseball Reddit, that Cody Bellinger has only hit one other pitch in that location for a hit in his career. I believe that's what it was. So, yeah, very surprised. I mean, it wasn't a bad pitch by any means. He just made an excellent swing on a ball that was pretty well above the zone. But no, I think my strategy for when games do overlap is just stick with the game that's ongoing and near the end, especially when it's a game as tight as Braves Dodgers was last night. Then you can just flip over to the other one as it kind of gets into crunch time. But I feel like the last few years we've been spoiled with really good playoffs. I just remember thinking each of the last at least two, maybe even 3 years, the playoff games and the series were all compelling, competitive, close, and just really engaging. And that's continued to be the case. I mean, Braves Dodgers, it's been three walk-off wins for the first three games. And I don't know how you could ask for more than that. That series especially has been a lot of balls in play, a lot of base running excitement, defensive plays, a lot of base running blunders too at the same time. The one thing that kind of jumps out to me is just starting pitching. Seems like if you can get a pitcher go five innings, you are thrilled. we've had a lot of pitchers come out after 3-4 innings. And obviously we've kind of trended in that direction, but no, I think overall the playoffs have been really compelling. And I'm curious to see what happens now. It wouldn't be surprising for me really for any outcome in the World Series at this point, but do you have any favorites for the World Series? Are you leaning towards any team? Do you think anyone's jumped out and really impressed you? What are your predictions for the rest of the way here?
I think the two best teams still in the playoffs are the Dodgers and the Astros. But like you said, at this point, it's not like there's some heavy favorite in either series.
Yep. One note that I saw last night that it probably shouldn't have been surprising to me, but I was surprised. I think Baseball Reference tweeted this out, but Jose Altuve became the leader in postseason home runs by an infielder in MLB history with 21 career postseason home runs, which is just fascinating to me because his career, I mean, I don't know who we're going to compare him to, but it in some ways it's similar to like Dustin Pedroia for me. I mean, he was always an underlooked guy coming up. I think we ranked him number 28 in Houston's organization in 2011 in our top 30 rankings. And just going back and looking at his scouting report, then it's pretty impressive all around. And the biggest criticism is just his size. I guess at this point, we still had a bias against smaller players that I really think is gone away to a large degree now. I know you've talked about this a lot, Ben, but just reading his report, and you guys can check that out on Baseball America to read his full scouting report. It's just really impressive the player that he has developed into, a guy who has 164 career home runs over 11 years, is a 308, 360, 462 career hitter, led the league in hits 4 times, led the league in average 3 times. Like, I mean, he's pretty safely a Hall of Fame type player at this point, right?
There might be a little hiccup in his resume
for sure.
Some people might hold against him, but just in terms of the performance, I think he's on that trajectory. I mean, he's just such a complete hitter. It's he has, like what we talked about, he has a small strike zone. You have a narrower window to work into if you're a pitcher, just because he is so small. And even though he's short, he doesn't lack strength. He has power. He has tremendous plate coverage, hand-eye coordination, ability to make contact with fastball, breaking ball, changeup, doesn't matter what type of pitch, where in the strike zone it is. It's a short, compact, adjustable type swing, a ton of contact, swings at good pitches. Just there really aren't many holes in his game as a hitter. I know a lot of people hate him now, but he is a really fun player just to watch if you just appreciate such a player with who is that complete of a hitter.
Yeah, absolutely. He's always fun to watch. And another shorter player who we were not as light on in our org rankings, who also had a pretty impressive postseason, is Wander Franco. He hit a pair of home runs in the series against Boston. I think he hit 368 over that series, 7-for-19. He was impressive in the playoffs. He was impressive in the regular season. He is a shorter hitter. He's a guy that you've been very high on for a long time. Not that you were the outlier or anything there. He was our number one prospect for 2 years. What is your, I guess, what are you thinking about Wander Franco now after his impressive rookie debut this year, how he's performed in the postseason? Has your expectations for Wander Franco, have they changed at all, or is it just kind of in line with what you expected? And I guess, what should we continue to expect to see out of this kid moving forward?
I think my expectations were just already extremely high for him. But at the same time, look, like we've seen with Jared Kelenic, or shoot, I mean, going back to Mike Trout when he first came up, you don't necessarily think every player is going to be a star right away, even if you think they're going to be a star in the future. There's a transition process sometimes, and it just doesn't seem like there's really been much of any hiccups along the way for Wander Franco in the big leagues. And I continue to think this guy is going to be a perennial all-star. And I think we, at some point, maybe in the very not too distant future, we will be talking about him in the Soto, Tatis, Vladdy Jr., Ronald Acuna echelon of players. I mean, as far as the athleticism and some of the other tools that like Tatis and Acuna bring to the table, in particular, I don't know, Franco doesn't have that. But this, he's just, I mean, a lot of the things we were just talking about with Jose Altuve as a hitter, Franco has a lot of those same traits, and he does it from both sides of the plate. And maybe he can play shortstop. You know, how long does he stay there? I don't know, but look, I mean, one of the concerns on him coming out of the Dominican Republic when he signed at 16 was, oh, he's kind of like a thicker lower half type guy, like good hands, but does he, you know, eventually lose enough range where he ends up at second or third base? And I still think that could be the case, but I think this is a Jose Ramirez type of offensive player, and he could develop into that, you know, defensive skill set too. But right now he's handling himself at shortstop. I think we're going to be talking about him among the game's true star players, maybe even by next season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't see any reason why we wouldn't start talking about him. I expect him to kind of be in that phylum of player that you mentioned. If you had a rookie of the year vote, would you vote for Wander as your rookie of the year? I think I probably would at this point. I mean, it's tough. I can see people getting hung up with the amount of innings and games that he played. He only played 70 in the regular season. Jonathan India, who is probably a favorite for that award, played 150, really a full season from him. But I mean, in the time he was given, Wander was playing really like a 6 WAR player. Per Fangraphs, of all the eligible or qualified rookies, he led all of them in that category, if we're just prorating his WAR for an 162 game season. So in the games that he was playing like a 6 WAR player, which is better than anyone else. That's pretty impressive to me. Hitting 288, 347, 463, good plate discipline numbers, obviously playing a premium position. I'm still a little bit skeptical about long-term how he's going to stick at that position. There are a few plays in the postseason that you probably want your shortstop to make, but at the same time, I'm not ready to overreact from a few plays in his first ever playoff appearance. But I am very confident that he's just going to continue hitting and basically, like you said, be one of the game's young premium players. I'm excited to see what happens with him. But if I did have a rookie of the year vote, I think I would probably give it to Wander. I don't know that it's the same as an MVP award, where really the value you get from the player over the whole season should matter as much. It obviously wasn't Wander's fault that he was playing in the minor leagues for so much of the season. The Rays brought him up when they thought they needed him, and he was obviously a very useful piece in their playoff run. So I think I'd probably give it to him. I think the overall talent and his performance in the time he had is very compelling to me. So he'd probably be my guy.
I could see that. Yeah, I don't think there's another runaway candidate in the American League this year. I mean, his teammate, Randy Arozarena, who like nobody thinks is an actual rookie, but is.
Right? Just an older, a little bit older rookie.
Yeah, a little bit more. Well, I don't know if he's more famous coming into the year. Would he be more? Yeah, maybe the general public would know more of Arozarena
than Franco?
Yeah.
I wonder. That's probably actually an interesting. Maybe for his playoff performance last year, maybe the casual fan probably, but I imagine most BA readers or prospect hounds probably the at least the same amount of recognition for both those guys. I mean, Wander is a two-time number one player or number one prospect in baseball. I feel like that holds a lot of weight.
And in the Dominican Republic, dude, like I'd be going down to the DR and I would just get like an Uber from the airport to the hotel or wherever I was going. And like, it'd just be like talking to like the Uber driver. Oh yeah. Like I work in baseball. And he'd be like, tell me about like Wander Franco. I'd be like, Wander Franco, like the 17-year-old kid in the Rays. Just like, he was already super famous in the Dominican Republic from basically the time he signed and was our number one international signing at the time. And then, yeah, he's always been pretty big time down there. But obviously a Rosarena's postseason stuff is kind of on another level. I mean, I think like Luis Garcia with Houston had a really nice season. He'd be a good candidate. But yeah, I mean, for Franco, the value that he created, even in the shorter amount of time he was up, if he wins the rookie of the year, I think it is a deserving candidate too. Yeah. And go ahead. I was just saying he's like such a baseball rat too. Yeah. Like in that same way of like Tatis and Soto and like these other guys. Like I remember the Rays, I forget how long it was after he signs, but they had some, you know, it was like after the season, they had some camp in the Dominican Republic. It must've been like not too long after he signed, maybe the year after. And so, you know, they have, you know, their stuff at the academy. He was there. And then like, he would go home back to like Bunny where he's from. And I forget if like he put maybe like posted videos on social media or just like, you know, they heard about it because word travels quickly. Like he'd just go home and like be playing more baseball back at home. And they had to be like, all right, like Wander, like we love you. Like we love that you are addicted to baseball and don't want to ever step away from the field. Like we want you to rest and be ready to go. Yeah. It's like, it is a long 140 game minor league season. We don't want you to get hurt. Like
it seems like a great sign when you feel like the concern is your player is playing too much. I feel like that's fantastic to hear.
You can't pull him away from the field, and you can see the way he plays the game and everything he does. You could just see it. I mean, I saw him when he was 15. I know other, you know, people who, you know, work in international scouting, obviously were following because he was a famous guy. I mean, look, he's like the nephew of Eric Ibar. He comes from a baseball family. His older brothers, Wander Franco and Wander Franco, also were former minor league players or were minor league players at that time. So people knew him from a very young age. But even just seeing him when he was 15, there was just you could just see he was not just the best hitter on the field, but one of, if not the smartest players on the field too. And now you're starting to see more power come out too, which is, you know, we see that as guys, I mean, shoot, what is it? Like, I think he's still 20 or 21. I was going to say, we see that as guys.
Yeah. You know, he's still 20. He'll turn 21 in March next year, which is insane.
Yeah. So like we're still what, 5 to 7 years away from his physical or what should be his physical prime. So I think even though we haven't seen big power numbers from him throughout his minor league career, he has a ton of bat speed. There's raw power in there. I just think his mindset, which is a good one to have as a young hitter, was to make contact, put the ball in play, use the whole field, not try to sell out for power. I just think as he, one, gets stronger and two, becomes a smarter hitter and learns which situations to look to drive balls. And you're already starting to see him do that, but figure out which are damage counts and damage pitches to try to swing at. You're going to see, I think, a lot more power than what he's even shown to date.
For sure. And it's obviously a different offensive environment, but even just going back to Jose Altuve, his first 3 years, he had a slug under 400 for each of his first three seasons, including a partial 2011 season, hit two home runs that year in 57 games, seven home runs in 147 the next season, five in 2013, and then seven in 2014 before he really even got to double digits and started being more of a power threat that he's kind of known as today. Wander, I mean, his first partial season, 70 games, already hit seven home runs, 18 doubles, had a 463 slugging percentage, which was a lot better than Altuve over his first 3 years. So yeah, I'm pretty confident that power is going to be a pretty normal part of his game that you can kind of expect to come as soon as next year. I mean, it's just such a, for hitters that good, I feel like we've just come to assume they're going to tap into a decent amount of power when you've got that sort of barrel control and you're consistently getting premium contact. The ball's just going to fly in today's game. I wanted to ask you, Ben,
Jose Ramirez, who, you know, I mentioned before and kind of feels like a lazy comp because it's like two shortstops from not just the Dominican Republic, but both from Bunny and like their boys, like they're like really, really close growing up. But it really does fit for me as a comp. Josh
texted me and said, this is a horrible comp, Ben. That's just coming in right now.
The comp police have come and spoken, but Jose Ramirez coming up through the minor leagues with a lot less fanfare, and a lot less fanfare than he, should have obviously gotten. He was very underrated as a prospect. Not that he performed this quite to the same level that Wander did, but coming up, he was always a guy who also put the bat to the ball a lot, made a lot of contact, and did not hit for really any power in the minor leagues. It was like, you know, three home runs, five home runs, even single digit home runs early in his major league career. But again, as he got stronger, became a smarter hitter, just with more experience, he turned into a guy who's pretty consistent 30 plus, bordering on 40 home run guy. So if we see that from Wander Franco at his peak, I would not be surprised. And in fact, that's what I don't think he's consistently going to be a 35 plus home run guy, but I do think we will see some seasons from him where he does produce at that level.
Yeah, I like that. Jose Ramirez has two seasons with 35 plus. I know in our scouting reports of him coming up through the system, he peaked at number 9 in the Indian system. And one of the questions was, will he have enough power to profile at third with his kind of defensive question marks? Where is he going to settle in? And obviously he's answered that question. What I was going to ask earlier about Wander, Ben, is he the best pure hitter that you've seen personally, or where would he stack up with some of the other players that you've seen personally? I know Vladdy was also a guy that we gave an 80 pure hit tool. So I'm just kind of curious, who are the upper echelon pure hitters that you've seen or you've covered, and where does Wander stack up with that group?
Probably just as far as pure bat to ball, he's probably a touch better even than Vlad Jr. was. Now, pure bat to ball is not everything. I'm not saying like Nick Madrigal would be a better hitter than Vlad Jr., for example. Like there's more to it than just being able to put the ball in play if it's really like contact. So if you're just looking at that, I would give Franco the edge. Now as an overall hitter, I would give the edge to Vlad. I mean, Soto obviously belongs in this conversation. Mm-hmm.
I think he was another guy who kind of just exceeded expectations. No one really expected in the sense that they did with Vladdy and with Wander even. He just moved
quickly. I mean, the thing with Soto is he was in the minor leagues for like 11 minutes. I mean, he came out, won the GCL batting title. The next year he got hurt, so he didn't play much. And then he didn't play much, and it was only in low A.
Yeah, I had the Nationals handbook chapter 1 year and ranked Soto behind Victor Robles. I would definitely take that one back if I could.
But like he just like came to the big leagues in like a blink mm-hmm. that year. So it's hard to put him on the same playing field as a prospect compared to like what we saw from Franco.
Yeah.
Or
he played 122 games Jr. in the minors over three seasons. Yeah, like
we didn't see Juan Soto in the upper levels of the minor leagues to be able to compare, but obviously he's on his own planet as far as, you know, pure hit on base
just skills. His 2018, I know we kind of talk about it in passing, but his 2018 season was insane. He started at Low A Hagerstown, played 16 games there.
He hit repeating the level.
Yes.
So the Nationals had him repeat. I understand he was mm-hmm. injured the year before, right?
Yeah. But he hit 373, 486, 814, 16 games, was moved up to High Potomac. 15 games there, he hit 371, 466, 790. Then he was promoted to Double A, where he played just 8 games, 323, 400, 581. And then he was promoted to the majors. He got 116 games as a 19-year-old and put up a 292, 406, 517 line with 22 home runs, 25 doubles, 99 strikeouts to 79 walks. Like, that's insane. He had a 142 OPS plus in 162 games after starting the year in Low A. Great OPS plus. Also, the lowest OPS plus of his career. Insane.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, do you think the Nationals saw that coming when they started him back in Low A?
I know they were. When I talked to people with the Warriors, they were very high on just his ability to make adjustments in his hands in the box. But I mean, even they would admit, I think they did not expect a player that we see today to come out of that. Like, he had to have exceeded everyone's expectations. So, man,
no, pretty impressive. I don't think they saw a player who would put up
Ted Williams comps.
400 on base, 500 slug.
Yeah.
In the same season where they, you know, assigned him to start the year in Low A.
He has a career 432 on base percentage. That's insane.
I mean, his walk to strikeout numbers are.
You remember when we did sign ridiculous. One, trade one, cut one with Fernando Tatis, Ronald Acuna, and Juan Soto? I don't think anyone took Soto. Probably need to go back and I still think you can make cases for the other guys, but man, Soto is just impressive. I think Josh at the beginning of the season said he thought Juan Soto was the best hitter in baseball, including Mike Trout. And I mean, after this year, obviously Mike Trout was injured, but if you're just talking best pure hitter without overall value, defensive value, base running value, I mean, it's a pretty easy argument to make. So.
Oh yeah. The on-base skills that he has are...
Yeah, the play discipline is unbelievable. The way he's able to lay off the high fastball and not even just lay off high fastballs in the strike zone, like his ability to decipher a ball that's just above the zone versus a strike that he can do damage in inside the zone is unbelievable.
He's also my favorite hitter to watch from the open side. When he swings, like his barrel just gets so deep into the hitting zone. It gets there so early. It stays on plane for so long. It looks like he's going to be a catcher's interference every time he swings from the side. Like he's just going to smack the catcher in the helmet or something because he gets his barrel so deep into the hitting zone. Mm-hmm. So even if he's early, he can catch it out front and drive it out to the pull side. If he's a little bit later or the pitch is on the outer third, he can let the ball travel deeper. He doesn't need to be precise with his timing, so he can catch it deeper mm-hmm. and drive the ball with impact to the opposite field or out of the opposite field, and that's why you see so many mm-hmm. big home runs from him, not just to the pole side, but the opposite way too. He's just, that's such a fun swing to watch. And you combine that with the incredible pitch recognition and discipline that he has. And you have this, you know, mutant on base skill type guy who, you know, who also has, you know, 30 plus home run power.
At this point, his power is probably underrated just because people so quickly go to the plate discipline. That's just so rare in the game. Like if he wanted, and if he wanted to lead the league in homers and adjust his approach to do so, I feel very confident he could easily do that.
Yeah. And another guy too, who I say like early on in his career, like he still is early on.
He's 22 years old. You
know, right. But like when he signed coming out of the Dominican Republic, like, you know, he was considered one of, if not like the, it's like one of the best pure hitters available, but you know, as you can see, he doesn't really run, he doesn't really throw that great. But you know, one of the questions was, all right, he is a very good pure hitter, but he's going to have to play a corner, and is he going to have enough power to carry him? Again, this is when he was 16 years old. So like 16, 17 years old, is he going to have enough power to carry him on a corner? And it's another one that's, you know, he's just gotten with him, I think it's just significant strength gains since the time he signed and early on in his career. And he started to flash that early on in the Gulf Coast League a little bit, but another guy where it's the kind of guy I like, where it's a very advanced pure hitter who knows a strike zone, has good bat to ball skills. And even if there's not power there early on at the time, especially as a teenager, it's something you can grow into more as you get older. And I say that as, again, Soto is another guy who's still about a half decade away from maybe his typical physical prime years. Yeah.
And happy early birthday to Juan Soto. He will turn 23 on October 25th. So that's coming up shortly. But he's going to be a free agent in 2020. Nice. Yeah, he's going to be a free agent in 2025. I can't imagine the contract that he's going to get at that point. It's going to be
a five.
Unbelievable, man. All right. Well, I'm glad that we transitioned into that Juan Soto conversation. That was fun, not planned. But, you know, that's the benefit of this podcast format, Ben. We can just let you talk about things and share your wisdom with us. But I know you wanted to talk about the Rays as well. It seems like people feel very strongly about the Rays for good or for ill. What are your thoughts on this? And I guess you can just give some background as to what this topic even is.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Rays were playing the Red Sox in the playoffs and got eliminated. And it's just kind of wild to me how these very strong reactions that the Rays elicit from people who don't like them for various reasons. Like, I think they're a great run organization. They won a ton of games this year. They have a very good farm system. I think they're fun to watch. Like, I love watching Franco and Randy Arozarena and shoot, like, Kiermaier, and center field is unbelievable, and Glass now. But like, as soon as they get eliminated, people just like jump up and down to like,
see you later, nerds.
Yeah, like so that's one aspect of it. Is I think there's a segment of folks who don't like them because of analytics,
Very odd, considering every team that's currently in the playoffs is heavily influenced by analytics, and really the majority of teams in baseball at this point are. I really think the financial component comes in. I don't know why they get the target on their back for being the analytics team when there are dozens of them. But for some reason, you're right, they do. Maybe it's just because they have such a small payroll and are also still really good, so they're just kind of dubbed the analytics team. But it is odd.
Yeah, it's like this. People have this idea of this analytics boogeyman that's out to ruin baseball in their minds. But like you said, I mean, the teams they lost to, okay, they lost to the Red Sox, a team that is very quantitatively oriented and has been for a long time. Maybe less so when
and the guy running their team came directly from Rays ownership or race right. general manager.
So, So Chaim Bloom obviously came over from the Rays. They're now playing the Astros, who are as quant heavy and I would say just as non-traditional as anyone in the league. And oh, by the way, their GM is James Click, who came over from the Rays.
Maybe this is really why, because all the people running teams that are just, I guess, have a reputation for being analytics heavy, they're the people running the team just came from the Rays. I mean, the same is true for the Dodgers.
But then that's what I don't, right. Like, yeah, the Dodgers, Friedman was there, former, you know, they beat the Giants, like Farhan is, you know, the former
really old school A's team of the Giants.
Yeah. Like those are like two of the most quantish executives in the game, or, you know, the Braves who brought aboard a bunch of the Astros analytics folks. And I think
Mike Fast, Alex Anthopoulos is pretty heavily into the analytics. I mean, it really feels like every team is at this point. There are only a couple you could point to and be like, they really aren't with the game here.
Yeah. Yeah. They're very, I think, data driven in their decision-making. So yeah, I mean, if you think the Rays losing to the Red Sox is some loss for analytics or quantitative analysis in baseball, I just don't think you have a very firm grasp on the reality of how these
if you're making any comments offices. About like analytics losing, I feel like you are clueless about the state of the game. Analytics won a long time ago, and that's why every team is being run by nerds. I say nerds, I don't say that pejoratively, I say it mostly jokingly. But yeah, if you're not running a team with a heavy analytics blend in your decision making, you're behind the curve. It's as simple as that. I mean, yeah. Moneyball came out in 2001, or it was about 2001 team, early 2000s. I feel like we've been having this conversation for multiple decades now, and I'm curious when it'll end, if it'll ever end.
I don't know if some of the players we talked about that on this podcast were even alive when that
came out, like one. Certainly not everyone in the upcoming draft classes after that. So we've literally got a generation under our belts since the analytics revolution has started, and we're still having these conversations. Yeah.
I think a lot of people are just projecting whatever gripes they have with modern baseball onto either analytics as a buzzword or to the Rays as an organization, because it's just pretty detached from reality. But but the other, like you said, I think the payroll aspect comes into it too.
I think part of it is just as simple as when teams consistently win, a lot of people start to hate them, regardless of the team. I think this can happen with anyone, but I can see it especially being frustrating for teams or fans of teams in the American League East who spend a lot of money on their payroll. And then you get a team like the Rays, who are near the bottom of the league in that department, who have won arguably the best division in baseball the last 2 years, came in second the year before that, and have generally just been competitive while doing excellent moves in player acquisition and player development in the draft. It's just easy to hate a team that does everything well and is successful regardless. But I do think, the financial component and just the negative connotation that analytics, like you said, as a buzzword still has in the game.
Yeah, I think the rate, like they're like an inkblot test for a lot of people to just project whatever issues they have or are working through onto them. I think the payroll thing is, I think it's a labor issue for some people. They just don't like that the Rays don't spend money don't spend much money on players. Mm-hmm. But I mean, look, like, I don't know, like they won 100 games in a division where three teams made the playoffs and the fourth, the Blue Jays. I mean, I don't think if the Blue Jays got into the playoffs, I would not be surprised if they ended up winning the World Series. If they had been able to sneak into the playoffs at the end, like that's a really good team. But I mean, the Rays have a strong farm system. They scout well. They sign good international players. I think their pro scouting is pretty great. I don't think that's a controversial statement by any means. Like I think they've made some fantastic trades. They made a lot of really smart baseball decisions, and they're fun to watch. I mean, you could say, you know, they haven't won a World Series. Like, all right, like that's true, but there are 10 teams in the playoffs. And I mean,
the Dodgers were the best team in baseball for like a decade and they didn't win a World Series. So
yeah, I haven't done a study on this, but I'm pretty sure since they've gone to 10 teams, 9 out of 10 teams every year do not win the World Series. Like seems pretty remarkably consistent year to year. Like it's a tournament. It doesn't decide who the best team in baseball is. It just declares the champion of the tournament. And in a 5-game series, the best team in baseball can lose to the worst team.
Absolutely.
The Red Sox might end up going to the World Series. They might end up winning the World Series. And they started the season getting swept by the freaking Orioles, man. Like things like that happen.
Being a 100-win team in the regular season is more impressive than winning the World Series to me. I mean, it's more difficult to do. It speaks more to the quality of your team, the strength of your team. And obviously the World Series is the goal. That's what everyone's trying to achieve. I'm not trying to knock that, but there's just a lot of randomness that's involved in the playoffs when you're dealing with the best teams in the league playing, like you said, 5- and 7-game series. Anyone can get hot at that point. So you got to get lucky as being good in the playoffs.
I mean, it's a razor thin series, and what a better series to, I mean, if you can't see the example of that in that specific series between the Rays and the Red Sox, that could have easily swung the other way based on how a baseball ricochets off of an outfielder's leg. what better example to see like how things could just easily swing either way. Like, this is a team that won 90 games for 4 straight years. Well, not 2020, obviously that was a shortened season, but they did go to the World Series.
They were on a 90 win pace. They had the best winning percentage. I mean, they've had since, actually that was their best winning percentage of all time that year. So it's not like they were bad just because they didn't get the wins total on a shortened season.
Yeah. I'd call it a good season. So yeah, look, I mean, ultimately the goal is to win a ring, but I think this is an extremely successful franchise that's, you know, makes good decisions, is fun to watch, and did so in a very challenging division this year. So I think a lot of things on criticisms that they get are not entirely well founded.
Yeah. Well, we are, I think we're solidly Team Nerd on this podcast for many different reasons. But with that, we're going to go to a quick break. We'll be back to talk about some Arizona Fall League, Jupiter, and a few other things before diving into a few questions. So thank you guys for sticking with us so far. We'll be right back. All right, we are back. Thank you guys for sticking with us. Ben, the Fall League is underway. Josh Norris is obviously super amped about it. I think this is his Christmas every year. He loves the Fall League so much. For me, the Fall League is never a very high priority coverage area or event, just because of I'm just focused on the draft. And when I'm done with draft stuff, I just pivot to Prospect Handbook. But that's not to say it isn't a very important league or time of year. What is your experience with the Arizona Fall League? What are your thoughts on it? And why should we care, I guess? If I need to even put that out there for our listener base, I'm sure they're all shaking their heads right now as I even pose a question to you.
It's fantastic. I mean, if you're listening to this prospect, or if you're listening to the podcast, I'm sure you love following prospects, and there's no better time to see prospects as a fan than going to the Arizona Fall League. If you just care about prospects from all clubs, like, you know, if you just care about one team, that's a little bit different, but it's just such a great atmosphere in Arizona. It's, you just roll up, tickets are cheap. There's not a ton of people in the stands. You can pretty much sit wherever you want. It's easy access to the players. Like, you could probably shout something to the player at third base. I'm sure he'll hear you. Like, it's just, and there's so much talent out there, especially position prospects. Arms, you know, a little bit more hit and miss, but I mean, shoot, man, like even the arms that are not that good, or I shouldn't say not that good, but like the guys who are not the top prospects who might be more relievers or organizational guys are still throwing like 95 these days. So, you know, there's still some velocity that these guys are facing out there to get tested against. And you can see, you know, game in the afternoon, game in the evening. It's good weather that time of year, usually in Arizona. It's not like oppressively hot. So it's just a great atmosphere to see him. And unfortunately, you pretty much have to go there if you want to see these games, because MLB, for reasons I do not understand, does not stream these games. It's really bizarre.
If only they had a really good streaming service they could use that everyone had easy access to, they could put them on. That would be great.
Yeah, that must be the roadblock. They should invent MOLB TV, as you would probably call it. Like that would be a good idea.
No, the vowels don't work out. You know, the vowels don't work out. Can't do it.
Oh, okay. Is that it?
Yeah, so, that's it.
But like, dude, just like set up. I don't understand. Like, I can watch. I can sit at my home, pull up my computer, and watch streams of multiple Chase Petty high school baseball starts from a very typical New Jersey high school baseball field, because, you know, a couple guys like, you know, set up some cameras and stream it and produce a broadcast that is on par, if not better, than many MILB TV streams. Yet Major League Baseball can't figure out a way to do that. Like, they can't have
compete
like
with the playoffs,
or
man.
Or college students, or like something like what? I don't understand. Like, why are you not helping to market? Like, you have like Spencer Torkelson and
I have Marco no idea Luciano, why, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if it was as simple as the playoffs are happening and MLB doesn't want to distract from the playoffs in any way. But you're right, 100%. There'd be a ton of people.
I actually think it's they just don't think about it. Like, they just don't think about it and they just don't care. Like, if it's not major league, things below the major leagues, they just don't really care much about. And it's really, they really never have. I mean, they've tried to make a bigger deal, obviously, of the draft, but they're just not like totally committed to that. They don't view it through that lens. And some of the biggest and most marketable players are young players. Like Blaze Jordan is more, now he's not on the folly, but like he has more fans than some of the players who are on the major league roster for the Red Sox. I mean, kids are following these guys, and not just kids, like, you know, a lot of people are following, you know, both amateur and pro prospects extremely in depth right now. And I don't understand why MLB doesn't, you know, stream these games, and then you can chop up all the streams and just get highlights all off season to pump out on social media or to use on MLB Network or MLB.com or whatever you want to use it for. It's really, I hope it's something they can fix next year. So people have more access to be able to see these players and follow these games without having to buy a ticket to go to Phoenix.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like I've never been. It's one of the events that I would love to go to. It seems like all the events that I would love to go to and haven't been to yet are the bougiest and most comfortable and fun environments for baseball. The Cape Cod League, I've never been to. The Arizona Fall League, I've never been to. I just go to the ones where they play baseball all day in the Florida heat. Those are fun as well. I wanted to jump into a quick question from Steve Hardesty on Twitter, who brings up the Fall League and asks, who are some under the radar prospects who could climb onto the radar in the Arizona Fall League? I think it's a good question. Obviously dovetails with our conversation here. Before we answer, I would point to a few stories that Josh wrote for the site a few weeks ago. One is 10 players who could regain or reinforce their stock in the AFL. This one might not directly answer your question, how you posed it, because most of the names here are fairly prominent. In fact, all of them are either first rounders or very high profile international players, I believe. A second piece maybe fits this more, five prospects who could pop in the Arizona Fall League. I won't give away all of those names. You should go read it if you want to check out the full piece, which is definitely worth it. But I will just highlight Owen White is on that list. He was, I think the Fall League just released their Players of the Week, their first installment of that. And Owen White was the Pitcher of the Week, I believe. And then Spencer Torkelson was their Hitter of the Week. I'm pulling that up just to confirm. Yeah, Owen White tossed five innings of shutout ball and allowed two hits to be named the Pitcher of the Week for the Arizona Fall League. And then Brett Beatty, not Spencer Torkelson, was the Hitter of the Week. Although, given Spencer Torkelson's performance, he easily could have won that award as well. So that's one name that Josh had. Ben, are there any players that come to mind for you that maybe address Steven's question here? I've got a couple that I'm excited about that maybe are or maybe aren't under the radar enough to qualify, but who do you have?
Yeah, it's tough. If you're in the AFL, you've got to be on the radar, especially by our definition. But I think Curtis Reed, Curtis Mead with the Rays came into the year, came into the year in A-ball. I believe it was his first year in a full season league. They'd signed him out of Australia a few years back and really moved up quickly. I don't think he's a famous name yet, but he got to Durham, got to AAA by the end of the year as a 20-year-old. So he's in the Fall League. I think he's a guy who, if he, continues to hit out there with everybody coming in and seeing him, could be a guy who gets a little bit more attention. And then we've talked about Joey Weimer before, Brewers outfielder with a lot of size and physicality and tools and a lot of things going on in his swing coming into the year that he has modified. And those adjustments seem to really pay off for him, especially toward the end of the season this year with the Brewers. So seeing him, if he's able to have a big fall, you don't want to put too much stock into the AFL. It doesn't, override what you saw during the season, but for, if he continues to do that against the quality of pitching that's above what he saw during the minor league season at the A-ball level, I think he's another guy who probably could get some more attention.
Yeah, those are good ones. The guy that I'm looking at, I mean, he definitely might not qualify as under the radar for this question, but I think he's a guy who maybe people have forgotten a little bit about and has had a really good 2021 season overall. And that's Bryson Stott, who was a first round pick of the Phillies a few years ago, is currently the number three prospect in that system. After some of the arms they've taken, some of the prep arms they've taken subsequently in the first round, but he was really impressive this year, has improved his plate discipline, has improved his power a little bit, hit 299, 390, 486 between, really, he advanced two levels, started at high A, went to double A, then went to triple A. So a strong year for him and probably what you're looking for when you're starting out as a 23-year-old in high A. I think that was encouraging. So far in the Fall League, he's off to a hot start. He's ninth in hitting at the moment. And if you just look at the players with more than 10 plate appearances, he's fifth after Spencer Torkelson, Brett Beatty, Elijah Dunham, and Austin Wells. So he is a guy that I would point to as maybe a player who's kind of reclaiming some of the prospect stock that he had closer to his draft year. I've got a couple other middle infielders who are really interesting as well that are in the Fall League and are off to pretty good starts as well. Ivan Johnson is one who maybe qualifies more as a bit of an under the radar name. He was a fourth round pick by the Reds in 2019. And he was a guy who, when I initially saw him, I think I saw him at IMG Academy at an event that PBR ran that included some junior college teams playing against each other for like an early season tournament. I was really impressed with his just wrist strength and raw power that he showed as a switch hitter. I think he had a pretty solid season, 10 home runs, 19 doubles overall between A ball and high A ball. He's off to a good start. I think he's got a chance to stick out of middle infield position and show some pop. And then the other guy, again, a first round pick, so probably not truly under the radar, but to your point, Ben, if you're in the Arizona Fall League, I don't know if you really can be under the radar depending on how closely you follow prospects, but Justin Foscue, at the time he was drafted, I think there was some thought that it was a bit of a reach with where the Rangers took him, but he was a very polished college hitter. Everything I've heard of him so far this year is that he's continued to hit very well, posted really loud exit velocities. He's dealt with some injuries that really limited his time in 2021. He just had 62 games. But we've also heard really good things about his defense as a second baseman. There were questions about, you know, how much value was he going to add at the position? People thought he would kind of have to play second or third, and he would just be at best a neutral defender and really have a bat reliant profile. But he hit well this year. I think he is another one who's also off to a pretty good start in the fall league. It's just three games for him so far. But he is 4 for 11. I think he's a guy who has a chance to hit for impact and also get on base at a decent clip. It's a right profile. So maybe that puts a little bit more pressure on your bat, but the early returns of him offensively and defensively really this year have been impressive. So that's another guy that I think if he performs and has just a really loud fall league, I think he could get maybe a little bit more recognition outside of either the Rangers circles or the really intense prospect hound circles. So a bunch of middle infielders from me.
Yeah, I think those are definitely guys who could pop with some big AFL numbers.
There are a number of corner infielders that have been impressive. We already talked about Spencer Torkelson and Brett Beatty just having really strong starts to the league. They are really the two best hitters in the league so far. If you're just looking at the players who have a decent sample of games, it's still early, so I guess everyone has a super small sample. But one player I wanted to mention, Ben, is Tristan Casas. And kind of as an entry point for our first sign one, trade one, cut one that we've done in a long time. Because recently we were talking about like really just how, at least for me, and I think this is true for most of the people at Baseball America as well, how difficult it is to separate and line up Boston's top three prospects. And I'm including Casas, their recent first round pick, Marcelo Meyer, and then Nick York, who obviously was the really polarizing pick they had in the 2020 draft, who has looked fantastic so far in his pro career. We're talking about kind of how to line those guys up, and I'm curious where you stand, and if you have an order, how would you sign one, trade one, cut one with Tristan Casas, Marcelo Meyer, and Nick York in Boston's organization? Very good three to have. I think it's a good problem to have when you're struggling to line these guys up, because they're all really exciting offensive prospects who are going to play the infield in some capacity. But do you have any strong order for these guys?
I think they're all, when we come out with our top 100, our new top 100 in January, even just starting conservatively, I think they're all top 50 prospects in baseball. I think they're probably all going to be in our top 40 also. And you could make a case that they all even belong in the top 30. Tristan Casas has done everything you could hope for from him or just about so far. The bar obviously is very high for a first base prospect, but the reviews on him from scouts are extremely encouraging. He is a selective hitter. He has a good approach. He has a fairly short type or a fairly efficient swing for somebody as big as he is at 6'5". So a lot of swing and miss issues that you see with other hitters his size typically are not there. He makes a lot of contact And if you see either the exit velocities or the distance at which he hits some of his home runs, I don't think there's any question that he has big time power too. So he's somebody I think will hit in the middle of a lineup and get on base at a high clip and hit for power and play pretty good defense too, potentially. So there's a lot to like with him. And I think just him having done it already at Double A and being pretty much on the cusp of big league ready, to me, he is the best prospect in the Red Sox system right now. That said, I think Marcelo Meyer, you can make the case, has the most upside. Now he's has the least track record of anybody between him and Cassis and York, but you have a player who looks like he could stick at shortstop and has a beautiful swing, seems to hit consistently in games. Now, saying that for a player who's only, you know, been at the high school level and the complex league level is different than, you know, say Cassis or Nick York, who's obviously dominated at the A ball level, but he has, you know, more positional value certainly than Cassis. He has more positional and more defensive value. He's just a better defender, even at his position at shortstop, than New York is at second base. And I think there's more power upside with Marcelo Meyer than there is with Nick York, even if you have more confidence in York's pure hitting ability, just based on, you know, scouting reports on York and track record with York. So if we're talking a year from now, or maybe even less than a year from now, just based on what Meyer does, you know, in the first half of 2022, you know, I might take Flip Meyer ahead of him, but for now, I guess I would sign Cassis. I would trade Meyer, putting him at number two and cut York. But again, I think York is one of the best pure hitters in baseball, and you can make a pretty compelling case that he's, you know, belongs in the top 30, 40 prospects in the minors.
Yeah. No, I think you kind of broke down all these guys really well. I think my list will differ from you. I feel fairly confident in Meyer number one. I do think all these players are very good in their own right, but I really love just the tier of player that Meyer is and was in his draft class is another level from where Nick York and Tristan Casas were in their draft class. I think I like the track record of the top, the best pure high school hitters in a draft class. The track record of that player specifically is really good. And also the track record of the top shortstops in any given, or high school shortstops in any given draft class, is really good. And Meyer pairs those two profiles together. He was number two on our board. You could easily make a case that he was the best prospect in the 2021 draft class. We never really had strong conviction from the industry on a single player, but you could easily make the case that Meyer was the top player in the class. I mean, just looking at, JJ posted this in our Slack the other day, but just looking at the track record of the top high school players for the high school shortstops and draft classes in 2020, you had CJ Abrams and Bobby Witt Jr. Witt was number two. Abrams was four on our draft board. In 2018, we had Royce Lewis fifth on our draft board. 2016, Brendan Rodgers was number one on our board. In 2013, Carlos Correa was six. In 2012, we had Francisco Lindor and Javi Baez as 7th and 18th, respectively. And then in 2011, Manny Machado was 3rd on our board. So just the track record of that profile in general, really of that list, Royce Lewis, at this point, is the only real question mark, I think. And then Marcelo Meyer was obviously number two on our board, with Jordan Lawler being the number one player this past year. I really love just the success of that type of player. And I think Meyer is a better pure hitter than a number of the other guys at the same time that I mentioned. So I like that combination of safety profile and upside, like you mentioned. I think he's going to hit for a lot of power. I think he's going to hit at a high level. So I think I like him one. Two and three, I really struggled with. I don't feel as confident in who I would trade and who I would cut here. And I think depending on the day, my answer would be different. But initially, I had York two and Casas three. So I think I'm just going to stick with that now. And I think one of the biases that I certainly have and have been burned by in the past is just emphasizing profile a bit too much. I think you make a really good point about Casas's offensive upside, his on-base skills, his power. I really have a lot of conviction in York's offensive ability as well. I was impressed with not only the pure hitting that he showed this year, but also the power that he showed. I mean, he hit 14 home runs and 20 doubles in low A and high A as a 19-year-old. That's pretty impressive to me. I think the way that the pick has panned out for Boston, despite it being controversial, also leads me to kind of buy into it a little bit more. I think there's definitely something the Red Sox saw with York as an amateur that maybe the rest of the industry didn't really get a chance to see, or maybe if the season had played out in 2020, we would think about him in a different light. And again, it's just credit to Boston for getting on him and taking a risk at the time that's looked really good so far. But the defensive position is really just going to be the tiebreaker for me here. And again, I think that is an area where in the past I've probably been burned by it at times, but I do think it's still important. So I'll go sign Marcelo Meyer, trade Nick York, and cut Tristan Casas. That'll be my order. And it all is always fun when we have different orders for these, Ben, but curious what,
Do you think Meyer's in the neighborhood of where like Bobby Witt Jr., your boy, mm-hmm. was when he was in high school? They're very different, mm-hmm. types of players.
I would put him a little bit lower than that. This question got brought up throughout the 2021 draft cycle just because the high school shortstop group as a whole was so impressive. Really, you can make an argument it's the best high school shortstop class we've ever had, just in terms of number of first rounders, number of high school shortstops in the top half of the first round. It really did set a new bar for that position, between Meyer and Lawler and Khalil Watson, Brady House, and others. I do think tools-wise and upside-wise, I think Bobby Witt Jr. was at another level. I mean, he's just more of an explosive player. He showed better raw power at the time, a much better runner, multiple grades better runner. If not three grades better runner. I know a lot of people really love Meyer defensively at shortstop. There are some guys who think he's going to be a really solid defensive shortstop. Some people think he's going to grow out of the position. And I guess that is an opinion that has developed now with Bobby Witt Jr. There are some people who think maybe he'd fit better at third just because of his physicality. But I think even then at the time, he was a more explosive defender in addition to being a very instinctual defender that Meyer is. I think I like his arms. I think just tools wise, Bobby Witt Jr. is at another level for me. But again, the hit tool is the most important, and you can make a case that Meyer had better pure bat to ball and better pure hitting ability than Bobby Witt Jr. did at the same time. So if you wanted to make a case, I guess you could. It would be tough for me to buy it though. I think Bobby Witt Jr. is another tier. For me personally,
so far so good too on those 2021 high school shorts. I know Jordan Lawler, mm-hmm. got hurt, but House,
yeah, Watson, they all performed in small samples. Meyer. Yeah, Meyer hit 275, 377, 440, and I think it was like a 120 WRC plus for that league. So even if those numbers don't like scream really impressive to you, it was a very solid debut. So yeah, high school shortstops. Give me all of the high school shortstops. That's the profile that I just fall in love with, and I think most people do. I'm curious to see how our listeners would line this up. Maybe we should do a poll on Twitter to find out how everyone else would line these three up. Because I think it's a great place to be in if you're Boston. If you're struggling to find out how you would order your top three premium offensive prospects in baseball, I mean, who really cares if you're Boston? You've got all three, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's the track record at the top. Not that I think they'll all be in the top 25, but they'll be close to it. I mean, mm-hmm. the track record of the top 25 players in baseball, certainly, or players in our top 100 who are at least hitting prospects is pretty good.
No doubt. And speaking of high school shortstops, there were a couple of high school shortstops that really stood out at Jupiter for me. Wanted to pivot into that event and kind of talk about a few players who jumped out. I did write a piece, a couple of pieces for Baseball America that really goes in depth to a lot of these players. There's 36 players in the 2022 class and then 9 players from the 2023 or 2024 draft classes on the site right now that you can see if you have not read those yet. But two of the more impressive players were Mikey Romero, who is a shortstop out of Orange Lutheran High School, the powerhouse Southern California high school that seemingly wins every National High School Invitational it goes to. He was really impressive. And then a more under the radar player who is certainly not under the radar anymore, Nicholas Perez, a shortstop out of BU Academy out of Puerto Rico, was very impressive as well. Both offensively, they stood out. And I think there are some scouts in the industry now that see Perez as a top Puerto Rican prospect in the class, which is certainly not the case prior to Jupiter. But those were the two that stood out to me. Mikey Romero's swing is becoming one of my favorites in the entire class. He's not the biggest player. He's fairly lean and thin. It doesn't look like he's a guy that's going to have a ton of power now, if you just look at his body, but his hands are so twitchy. His swing is fluid. He gets on plane early. He turns around velocity with ease. Like he faced a pitcher throwing. He touched 98 and turned around 95 like he'd just seen it every day of his life. It was really impressive to me. And I think he's a guy who is going to continue filling out, and he has the sort of bat speed and quality of contact that he's going to get some more power than maybe you would expect just looking at him physically. He's listed at 6 foot, 175 pounds, but I love everything about his swing. And he was probably the most impressive pure hitter at the event for me. So that's the guy I wanted to point out. Then Nicholas Perez, another smaller guy, kind of an undersized 6 foot, 175 pound player. But it's interesting with him because a year ago, I had some scouts who were telling me they saw him and he was maybe 15, 20 pounds lighter. So he was very small. Short and thin at that point. He's added a lot of physicality, but even a year ago, he was hitting for a surprising pop. There's something about the bat speed or the wrist strength or the quality of his contact where he can drive the ball more than you would expect. He was hitting cleanup for five-star National Black, which made it to the final four of the event, largely by his efforts offensively. He went 8 for 18 with a home run, 3 doubles, showed some pretty impressive plays defensively. Moves around pretty well, solid glove work. The arm was a little bit inconsistent for me, but when he's set up and in line to the bag, he shows off a solid average arm with good defensive actions overall. So those two guys really were impressive for me. I don't know if there are any, Ben, that you wanted to go into detail more with, but I figured we could talk about the Jupiter event as a whole, maybe dive into a few more players if you have the desire to.
Yeah, how was it overall, either the talent or mm-hmm. just the event this year?
I think this year the event was probably the most enjoyable Jupiter experience I've had, and maybe that's just because I missed it in 2020. It was actually in Fort Myers. I think they still called it Jupiter, even though it wasn't in Jupiter. But yeah, not going to that event a year ago and just not going to as many events period a year ago made really everything I did this year more enjoyable. We still had a few weather delays this year, which is inevitable, really, when you're going to play baseball in Florida at any point in the year, it seems like. I think the talent, we didn't have an explosive, like, wow appearance like what Mason Wynn had 2 years ago. I think that's probably going to be the kind of the high bar for a wow performance at Jupiter for me for a long time. It'll really be hard to top that. I think it was solid overall. A lot of the top hitters were at the event. Tamar Johnson, number one player in the class, was at the event. Drew Jones was there. Jason Jones, Mikey Romero, who now I think has a case as the top shortstop in the class at this point, and Cole Young, who would be the other guy that I point to for that title. He was there. A lot of the top hitters were just fine. Tomorrow only played a couple games. He had tweaked his either his hamstring or his leg and got pulled. So he only played three games and was kind of just normal Tomorrow. Didn't have anything crazy. Wasn't bad. Wasn't great. But his track record of hitting has been so established for me that it's hard for him to really move too much. Drew Jones is probably the hitter, the most high profile hitter I was looking forward to just getting some more ABs from. He hit the ball hard. He hit a lot of balls in the ground and didn't have a great Jupiter just performance wise. And I know there are going to be scouts who think he needs to make some swing changes moving forward, but he still continued to put the bat on the ball and hit the ball hard. Trying to think if there's any other players who are ranked highly that stood out. I mean, Cam Collier might now have a case as the best third baseman in the class. You've obviously been familiar with Cam as a player who was originally in the 2023 class who reclassified. I think most people probably would have him as the top third baseman in the class now. I guess another player who was maybe not in this kind of tier of prospects is Max Martin. He was very impressive the first day offensively. He had three really hard hit balls in each of his first three plate appearances. Really twitchy actions in the box and defensively. Later in Jupiter, he made a number of plays as a shortstop that I was kind of wowed by. So he's another guy who's moving up. And then the top pitcher for me was very clearly Levi Huseman, who is a left-handed pitcher out of Hanover High School in Mechanicsville, Virginia. And he was a guy who, I mean, this class of left-handed pitchers is really strong on the high school class. I did not expect him to come out and have the performance that he did. I mean, he might have had the best individual performance. He threw, I think, a complete game, seven-inning shutout against a Dallas Tigers team that had Jason Jones, struck Jason Jones out three times, struck out 18 batters in total on 102 pitches. And just the arm speed, the athleticism, his feel for strikes, 71% of his pitches were for strikes. He was 92-93 with his fastball, touch to five. And really what impressed me the most with him was his feel for a slider around 80 miles per hour, a little bit lower than that as the outing progressed. His feel to land that pitch in the zone for strikes, to put it below the zone, to backdoor right-handed hitters and as a chase pitch for lefties as well was really impressive. And easily the most dominant pitching performance of the event. So I think he's a guy who solidly put himself on the map if he wasn't already. I know he had pitched at a few other pretty high profile events this summer, but was never quite this good. So those are a few of the guys who really stood out to me.
Yeah, I got to go to the minority baseball prospects, All-American games.
What a loaded event that one was.
Yeah, it was fun, man. They had Tomorrow was there. Drew Jones was there, whole bunch of guys in that 2022 class, who will be high picks, and then some newer guys who are pretty intriguing. And then they had the underclass All-America game with, you know, Antonio Anderson and Trey Phelps, Ariel Antigua, Jaron Purify, a bunch of guys who are on our 2023 board already. So it was a good couple days to see those guys. Where did you see when Drew was playing, Drew Jones? He was playing the outfield.
Yeah, he was playing center field
there. Yeah. So because Elijah is usually Elijah Green is usually his teammate on that. FTB,
yeah, he was on that roster, but was not at the event. There were a number of players who were rostered and didn't show up. Sal Stewart was one. Gavin Turley, another guy. I was looking forward to seeing, but was not there. So that's pretty common for Jupiter, I would say, for a number of the top players to either shut it down or decide they need to rest up.
That's obviously a good outfield. And they had Max Clark, our number one for 2023 this summer on that team. So they won a few games, no surprise. But it was interesting seeing Drew Jones playing, like, during the game there at the – minority baseball prospects game, he was playing center field. That's his usual position, but it was interesting watching him, you know, before the game he took ground balls, he took in and out, He threw from the outfield, but he also came in and took ground balls in the infield.
Yeah, he did that at the baseball factory game as well.
Yeah, yeah. I was just I've seen him do that before. Never seen him play shortstop in a game, but just the fact that he's doing it tells me he must have some desire to play shortstop. But I also imagine that if you grow up, I mean, he's 6'3", he's a great athlete, and he's great defensively in center field. He's really good instincts, really good range out there. But when you grow up and your dad is, I mean, what, literally the best defensive center fielder of all time, maybe?
Yep, you can easily make that case, and I think I've stuck my neck out there and said that before. So,
and you have the same name as him, like, mm-hmm. All right, like it makes sense somebody's going to put you out in center field, right? But he keeps taking ground balls at shortstop, and I know some scouts are pretty intrigued by the idea of somebody who, I mean, he reads the ball really well off the bat in center field, so you hope that translates at shortstop too. He has the arm. He's a great athlete to be able to handle the position in theory and make adjustments. Now, when you watch him take ground balls at shortstop, he looks like somebody who's spent a lot more time in center field. He looks a lot more comfortable out there. I like, you just see the way he turns double plays, but he doesn't have a ton of experience or a ton of reps at shortstop. So I think some teams are intrigued by the idea of drafting him and saying, hey, like, would you go out and play shortstop? I mean, we can, and once you're in pro ball, you have a lot of time and a lot of coaches who can work with you, especially if you're a high draft pick or a high priority prospect like he will be, to really drill down with your infield coordinator, your other instructors, to work at your defense at shortstop. Do you see that as something that could happen with him, or is it even worth trying? I'm inclined where I see him just being so good in center field. And I think there's more value to being a shortstop than being a center fielder, but I don't think the gap between the two is as great as some clubs or some, you know, folks who work in scouting or for front offices have between the gap between center and shortstop. So I'm inclined to just say, I think he's a really good defender in center and let him go out and continue to be a really good defender out there. But I know some clubs are at least intrigued about what he would look like at shortstop if you just put him there and put him into, you know, professional development system, how he would look come a few years from now.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think a lot of it just depends on what he would want to do. If that's something he's interested in doing, I'd be much more willing to put him there and try it. If it's something where he's just more lukewarm, okay, you know, he has a chance to be an elite defensive center fielder. And like you said, that position is still very premium defensive position along the spectrum. I'm probably more towards the shortstop. The gap between shortstop and center field is still enough that it would be exciting to do. I mean, it's just harder to play the infield than the outfield. And especially when we're talking about shortstop, I mean, that's your most premium defensive position outside of catcher. So if there is at all any interest from Drew himself to do that, I don't see what it could hurt unless the amount of detail in his training and his development was somehow getting in the way of maybe offensive improvement that he needed to take steps forward with. If he didn't show the ability to kind of handle both at the same time, because there are some players who it doesn't seem like their defensive work takes away from or affects their offensive game in any way. That would probably be my biggest question, is he on track offensively in his development through the minor leagues? And are the shortstop reps that he's getting taking away from that or no? And if it got to the point where I felt like his offensive development, how he's handling like approach as levels progress, if there are any mechanical tweaks he needs to make, timing, that sort of stuff. If in any way the shortstop defense was limiting him offensively is when I'd start to get a little bit wary and would probably just say, okay, we know that you're an elite athlete. We know that you're a very instinctual center fielder and can make a tremendous difference for the team in terms of runs saved at a premium position in the outfield. Then you probably just move him there and let him do what he does naturally in the outfield and just focus on hitting. If he is the guy that can kind of handle both and whatever steps he would need to take defensively, because like you said, he would probably need some work there, just refining the details of that position and the smaller things. I don't know why you wouldn't want to try it, but again, those are questions that you probably, or not probably, you definitely need to know the player at a more intimate level to really answer effectively. And I don't know that I'm in a position to do it, but it's very intriguing to me. And I do think just from the reps that I've seen of him in the infield, it was a lot better than I expected the very first time I saw him kind of head to the infield. So I think it's certainly a player who could make it happen. And I'm excited to see what inevitably will happen with him. But at the end of the day, I think it's probably most likely that he just becomes a pretty terrific defensive center fielder.
Yeah, I think just the fact that, like, I don't see other outfielders just coming in and taking ground balls and during in and out.
So you really don't. The fact it is rare.
Just the fact that he's doing it makes me think he must want. There's probably some desire to at least try it out, right? Like it's an unusual conversion. You don't see guys typically going from the outfield to the infield, but I don't think we should necessarily limit a player to a position based on where his high school coach or his travel coach plays him. Like that's we shouldn't limit players in that capacity. So the argument, like, you know, the argument is all the things we talked about where that skill set could fit at shortstop with more development, and then worst case scenario, it doesn't work out. And yeah, you lost some time, but I mean, how much longer is it going to take for him to like get back up to speed in the outfield, right? Like I think he'll look pretty comfortable pretty much as soon as you put him back in the outfield. If you do make that change and be a, you know, have a chance to be a plus defender in center field.
Yeah. Agreed. Well, with that, again, if you guys want to check out the full notebook of Jupiter, definitely head to the website. I think Ben's going to have some notes up on some of the events he's seen this week as well. So depending on when you listen to the podcast, that will be on the website. Additionally, wanted to jump into a few listener questions here before we signed off for the day. Ben Finn on Instagram asked, who do you think is the best left-handed pitcher for the 2022 draft? And this question is a very tough one because there are a number of candidates that I think make sense. The college side has a lot of questions, more because of a lack of innings and injuries. That class obviously is still impacted by the COVID year, and scouts definitely have less feel for the college group as a whole than they would for a typical group. But if health wasn't a factor, I think Alabama left-hander Connor Prelip would be the pretty easy answer here for just the class overall. I mean, his pure stuff from like a pitch data perspective is outstanding. He posted a 0.96 ERA over 28 career innings with Alabama. And that is the sticking point with him. He does not have too many innings. He had Tommy John surgery last year that kind of cut his season short, excuse me. But he's got a mid-90s fastball and a mid-80s slider that's been one of the most dominant pitches of this draft class. It's a pitch that generated whiffs more than 50% of the time, which is just insane. So I'm very curious to see how teams are going to stack him up next year, because he was trending towards like number one player in the class if he was healthy. And if he didn't get hurt, it would be a very easy player to put at the number one spot. Whereas now we have kind of a cluster of bats that were difficult to kind of line up and see who's number one. So I think Connor Prelip, while he might not even pitch next year, is probably my favorite individual left-handed pitcher just because of the pitch quality. And then on the high school side, there's a cluster of four lefties that are inside our top 10 right now. And I've talked to a number of scouts throughout the summer and throughout the fall just kind of seeing who they prefer of that group. And it's one of those situations where, depending on who you talk to, you get a vastly different order. I mean, Jackson Ferris, I feel like, probably has the best combination of a deep arsenal, strike throwing, and projection with a 6'4", 190-pound frame. So he's kind of got a lot of the starter traits that I like. There have been some other pitchers that have showed more dominant stuff. Tristan Smith, when his breaking ball is on at PG National, it's one of the better curveballs that I've seen in the class. He also gets in the mid-90s from the left side. But at the same time, Smith is a guy whose track record of throwing strikes is a bit scarier. Brandon Barrera is a smaller guy, so maybe you have some questions about that, but he's got maybe some of the best arm speed in the class, been up to 96, throws a really good slider with tilt in the low 80s, has shown some feel for mid-80s changeup as well. Again, he throws that pitch with really impressive arm speed that adds the deception. And then Noah Schultz is like the spin rate king. Everything he throws is high spin. He's got that huge 6'9", 220-pound frame, low slot, really tough AB against lefties and righties, really great feel for his kind of slurvy mid-70s breaking ball. But just the spin traits for him overall are impressive. I think he's a guy, again, who has shown the questions for me would be like third pitch. Does he get to the changeup consistently? And you really don't see a ton of guys who are that tall that pan out very well. So I'd just have some questions in general about the size, but he is a guy who has great body control, seems to be a pretty good athlete, and is synced up pretty well consistently. So I know I'm just kind of listing our top guys here. I think at this point I would say Connor Prelip or Jackson Ferris, but I think you could have a number of different answers to this question. Ben, do you have any guys who jump out maybe that I didn't mention that you like, or a clear favorite of the group that I did mention?
Well, what's interesting is, I mean, take maybe set Schultz aside for a moment, but like, well, at least with Ferris, Brera, Tristan Smith, I mean, we just had the Royals take a left-handed pitcher in the top 10 picks of the draft. And maybe he wouldn't have, you know, certainly it was an underslot deal, but had they not taken him, he probably still would have gone somewhere in the first round.
There was tons of buzz on Frankie Mazzucato, like leading up to draft day, and I was expecting him to go somewhere in the back of the first. So I think you're right that he would have gone in the first regardless.
But those guys, and Mazzucato is young for the class, but still, I mean, we're still the draft is still what, 10 months away or something like that. So we're earlier in the process than evaluating Mazzucato on where he was on draft day. Mm-hmm. It seems like, I mean, you could argue Mazzucato's curveball maybe it certainly would be superior to a lot of these guys' breaking balls, but
yeah, I think that'd be a pretty safe argument at this point.
Yeah, but as far as fastball or just stuff overall, I mean, I think those guys are just as good, if probably not better, probably better than Mazzucato.
Yeah. I think from just pure fastball. And then, I mean, Schultz probably throws around the same velocity, but when you factor in just like extension, spin, the angle he gets on you, maybe you could say that his is better, but for sure.
Yeah. So we're talking about three or four guys who could go three or four high school left-handed pitchers who could go in the first round. And that's before, I mean, I think it just speaks to the quality of pitching in this year's draft, because we haven't obviously even got in like the right-handed pitcher with Lesko and Porter and then so many other guys on that side. But I think Schultz is, I'm not saying he's the best of this group, but he's the most fascinating to me. Cause like you said, he's about 6'9".
Yep.
It's just like Randy Johnson, Andrew Miller looking dude coming at you from a low slot, like Josh Hader hair, like same kind of arm angle and spin properties. And he doesn't throw as hard right now, but you can see strength projection in there for him to, I mean, he's getting into the low 90s now. I think he does. I mean, a lot of Mazzucato's fastballs still start with an 8. Scrape maybe a 93. But I think Schultz has the, and I think Mazzucato will throw harder still. There's good projection with him and a very easy delivery, and I like him a lot. But I think Schultz could throw a lot harder. It's a really tough slider to hit. Everything he throws is extremely high spin stuff. I think there's a lot of good projection indicators with him where I'm really, really intrigued and fascinated to see just what he turns into and how much of that projection too comes on by draft day. Because if he's, you know, come next, I mean, they haven't announced the draft date yet, have they? But come next,
no, we don't have it yet. July. But I'm assuming, I mean, based on everything I've heard, I'm assuming it'll still be tied to the All-Star break. So that should give you some idea of when it's going to be.
Right. So if, you know, if by June and July, he's getting his fastball up to 96, 97, and he has a really good slider, and he's coming at you from that really difficult angle, especially for left-handed hitters, I could see him climbing to the top of that list.
Yeah, and what's interesting too is like you said, this, it seems like at this point, this year's class is much stronger on the left-handed pitchers in general. Last year, our top-ranked lefty was Jordan Wicks. He was number 13 overall on the board. And beyond him, you had to get to 28 to get to Anthony Solomito. Then Matt Mikulski at 39, and 42 was Frankie Mazzucato on our board, kind of at the end of the process. Obviously, there's a chance there's another player that pops up like Mazzucato did, who just kind of off the radar for us now, who could wind up being the top lefty in the class. That's always a possibility, especially for pitching. Guys can really just come out of nowhere. But we do have four, like you mentioned, four high school left-handers in our top 10 on our left-hander list. And then on the college side, we've got Hunter Barco at 7, who we haven't talked about too much, but is a very strong pitcher in his own right, who in terms of innings and just quality of stuff, maybe is the left-hander you feel most confident in on the college side. Prelip at number 9 on our college list. And then Reggie Crawford, who I wanted to mention because he's a guy who's thrown just 7 innings for Connecticut in his college season, but was also the most impressive college pitcher for the collegiate national team this summer. So that's another guy that you just don't feel very confident in the history that he has. He's a two-way player. He's been a pretty good hitter as well, but scouts are really just intrigued with the stuff, the body from the left side that he showed just in flashes this summer. But you really have no strong feel for what he's going to do next spring. I mean, I think of, not to the same extent, because Jaden Hill had track record as a prep pitcher and performed in a reliever role with LSU, but kind of in that same capacity. It's a guy with a really impressive body, really impressive pure stuff, but you really just need to see him take the ball and start every week in college to feel confident that he's going to be a top of the first round pick. So there's still a lot of questions in this demographic, but I think we can feel pretty good about the just overall strength of the left-handed pitching in the class at this point, and how these guys perform over the next, 8 months will really just depend. And we'll be telling for us, hopefully there's more clarity. It's always nice when we do get some clarity here, but there are plenty of options if you like left-handed pitching, which the industry very much does.
Hopefully we didn't give Josh a heart attack from all these comps we just dropped.
I guess the last question we'll jump into today, because we have been going for a while here, is Jack Breen on Twitter asked, for the next podcast, is it harder to scout a high school player in a region like the Northeast than a player from Florida, since they are not playing against better competition? Or is it easier since they should stand out and you'll have a better chance of seeing all of his tools in game? I think this is a good one, Ben. And since you're in the Northeast, I feel like we can just throw it to you, because you spent really the entirety of last spring going around to high school games and scouting players up. I have a pretty clear cut answer for this that I feel like makes this question easy for me, but I'm curious to see where you're coming at it from.
I think it's always better to see players go up against good competition.
Yep. We're in agreement
here. It's tricky. It's tricky to get a read on a hitter when he's facing a pitcher who's throwing 71 miles an hour and who is not even going to like play college baseball or anything like that. So, and it's true too for international players too. I mean, like you see kids from the Bahamas and talk to scouts about, you know, hitters there, and it, it's sort of changed and evolved more over the years. Now some of those players go to the Dominican Republic, or they'll come over to the States and tournaments for Florida, and you'll see them against better pitching. But just the pitching that you see a kid from the Bahamas facing is not going to be, you're not going to see him facing as much velocity if you're scouting them in the Bahamas compared to a player who's the same age you're scouting in the Dominican Republic, where you're going to see him, you know, you can have him face a guy throwing 85 plus or 90 plus any time you want, pretty much. So it's the same thing in high school hitters. You get a better gauge on them when they're seeing better competition. If you do see a hitter struggling against bad competition, then I guess that's even more of a red flag. But it's hard to get too juiced up over, you know, seeing a guy crush a 73 mile an hour fastball with a metal bat in his hands.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't have a ton more to add. I think you kind of summed up exactly how I feel about it as well. If you could pick, I think it's always better to just have players facing the best competition they can. I mean, the players who are jumping out in that environment, you can feel a little bit better about their underlying ability than, like you said, players who are facing competition that really taps out at high school. So thank you guys for those questions. That's all for today. So we'll get out of here. Thank you guys for listening again. We really appreciate it. Continues to be fun to do this podcast with you, Ben. But I guess before we leave, do you have anything you want to plug for the listeners? Anything you're working on? Anything you want to draw their attention to before we get out of here?
Yeah, like you said, we got some more, like we were talking about earlier, I guess, in the podcast, when we're on the road so much, it's like, all right, now I have to come home and actually write up and go over all these guys, especially at those big WWBA tournaments that we were at in Florida. So I was at a couple of them. So we'll have some stuff on the top 2024 and 2023 guys in particular who jumped out at a couple of those tournaments in Fort Myers. And we have the prospect handbook too available now for pre-orders. Did you see who's on the cover of that, Carlos?
Yeah, pretty good player there. Pretty good player. Minor league player of the year, Bobby Wood Jr. on the cover. If you guys want to, it's not too late to jump on the bandwagon. He is not a major league player yet, so I'll still accept any newcomers who, for whatever reason, were not on board. You guys can get on board by pre-ordering our prospect handbook.
Yeah, if you're not on board at this point, I don't
know what you're doing. You don't listen to this podcast. This is your first time listening to the podcast. You're not on board yet.
But yes, we have that available for pre-order. Top 40 prospects really in each organization. We go 30 deep online, we go 40 deep in the handbook with some bonus supports and a lot more information in there. So we're in the process of putting that together. So appreciate all you guys who order that every year from us. So we love putting it together. So we're excited to have that available now at baseballamerica.com, by the way, is also the people you can order it from Amazon too. I think it's a little cheaper on Amazon, but you'll probably also get it later if you order through Amazon. If you order it through us, you'll probably get it faster that way. So and it's better for us too.
I think it's like a couple of weeks at the bare minimum that you get it earlier if you order from us, right?
I forget the exact amount of time, but typically, yeah, if you get
either way, every year it seems like faster, so. For sure.
And it helps us more, so we appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. In addition to that, we have Arizona Fall League coverage that's kind of ongoing from Josh and Kyle and the rest of the prospects crew. I'm sure JJ is just shaking with anticipation because the Rule 5 draft is approaching. So be on the lookout for coverage from that event. Although I guess it's still a decent bit away. I guess when you work with JJ, you realize it's coming sooner than most people. Still some more draft stuff that's going to come out before the end of the year. And like Ben said, I'm just plugging away at prospect handbook assignments at this point. So yeah, that's kind of what we have going on here. Again, thank you guys for listening to the podcast. If you have not rated and reviewed, it is still very helpful for us to do so. You can do that on iTunes. You can listen, subscribe to the podcast on any podcast listener that you prefer. And with that, for Ben, I'm Carlos. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.